Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios is CBS Interactive, PhD Strategy Director Chris Stevenson.
Hey there, Tim.
And former Aegis boss Lee Stevens.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome along. This week, the boss of the ABC's theory on why the Oz outed a blogger, Fairfax finally reveals its new strategy, not so different to the old strategy. No more hubris at Photon, or so they say. Qantas loses consumer trust. The iPad takes us from the Flintstones to the Jetsons. Really? In TV, The X Factor and The Block end on a high. Iron Chef doesn't. And once again, we're in the battle of the beer advertising. First today, we talked to Lee Stevens, until very recently CEO at Aegis. Are you technically, I know that you're on your gardening leave, are you technically still the boss of it? Or
no,
you have officially left the building?
It's all up to Harold now, Harold Mitchell, and I wish him all the best.
So it all happened, for those who don't know the details, Mitchells were effectively bought by Aegis globally. And Harold Mitchell now kind of runs Mitchell's MPG and the Aegis agencies, which is Visium and Cara.
That's right, and the digital agencies as well, Isobar and iProspect.
Which shows just how analog of me to forget the digital agencies. So I guess it was your first experience running a traditional set of media agencies as well as digital. How did you find it? How did you find the experience of the last couple
of
years?
I think, on the one hand, things have changed a great deal in media and traditional media, particularly with fragmentation of television and free-to-air television. But a lot of things, since I was in traditional media in 1995, a lot of things have stayed the same. And a lot of things are going to change, particularly you're seeing that change now in the magazine landscape. And I think that that's going to roll through traditional media, particularly as we start getting higher broadband speeds and the NBN rolls out.
What did you see as the big challenges, you know, that anyone faced, but that you were grappling with in your time in that role?
You're either playing a size game, so you're either influencing the market by your sheer size, and we never had that with Cara being our size. So you had to be the smartest. That means you had to attract the best people, and the brand didn't have a legacy of doing that. So the addition of the digital brands then allowed us to attract great strategy-led people, strategically-led professionals, and was able to reinvigorate the brand. So regardless of the loss of the Yum and the IAG business, where there was actually $150 million worth of billings added to the businesses, and many multiples of that, of its current position in profit. So, taken as a whole, it was an exceptional ride, but it's a very different ride to the ride that you had to play in the media game in the 90s.
And I guess you were also watching as a buyer things like, it was just that point when newspaper advertising was falling through the floor, I guess the same in magazines, TV was facing all those challenges. It must have been quite an interesting time to have that front row seat.
The GFC, we grew 100% profit in the GFC because we had a digital strategy and because we had a commitment to digital. And I think a lot of people got caught out during the GFC, and it was good not to. It was good to win one, because it's a tough game.
Yeah, and I suppose that was the other thing for you. You had the dual role, so you were running the Australasian operation for Aegis, but you also had a regional digital role as well.
That's correct. Yeah.
And how much of your time was sort of dedicated?
About 2 weeks a month. It was regional, and so I was in a plane, and my particular focus was, of course, at China and India. Although Southeast Asia, there's some of the biggest opportunities and the biggest profit opportunities are in Southeast Asia. But so two weeks were that, and 2 weeks were in town.
And I guess most people would probably conclude you're calling it a day because of the change of ownership, or rather the change of local management.
I have an absolute amazing amount of respect for the Mitchells, but you've got to remember, I've worked there before. I've spent 4 years with those guys.
So you helped set up eMitch, or you joined eMitch after it was
eMitch at the time I was there, so it had a rough time. It got off to a great start and then had a very rough time, was only about six staff.
So it launched just before the dot-com crashed, didn't it, initially?
It did, and so I joined the base of the dot-com gloom, if you like. And then by the time I left, it was 75 staff, and it was 25% market share of the display space in the market. Now, the market's changed. It's not about display media anymore. And that's really what attracted me to do this new venture.
Very, and just sticking with image for a moment, and it's very unusual for someone to be a sort of senior Harold lieutenant as you were, and then to leave, you know, to leave the Mitchell family. Yeah.
We left on great terms. First, not least of all, because the transaction between Mitchells and Image was a very profitable one. It was very profitable for everybody, and so that I had a tangible commitment, and so I also had a gardening leave provision there, and Harold very kindly relaxed that and let me start at Aegis Media much sooner than he could have. So it was a very good parting. Like I said, they're a great group of people. They're very good at what they do.
Although many people say you only work for Harold once. You know, otherwise, if you leave him, then you're probably not going to come back. You know, come back a second time.
Well, I don't know whether that's particularly fair. I know of people that when I was at the Mitchells who came back a number of times.
Mm. People would conclude, though, the reason you're leaving now is because you don't want to work for Harold again. That you've been there and done it.
It's not Harold per se. It's just that we've had a 4-year engagement with me working that particular way. I've learned a lot from what they do, but I've also learned a lot from how the market's changed, and also the new opportunities to work a different way. And it's today's my birthday. I've just turned 41, and I've decided.
Forgetting, of course, yes. You know, and I remember this time last year you were appearing on the Mumbrella Question Time. I think the morning after your birthday. So
I'm in much better shape this year.
Well, I was going to say, if you were nursing a hangover last time, you didn't show it.
Oh, I felt it. Good.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about the new role now, which starts early next year. Mm. So this is at Switch Digital.
That's right.
Going in as
CEO.
And with some equity in it as well.
That's right. I've taken an equity position. I've invested money as well and taken an equity position. I've teamed up with my ex-chairman from eMitch, Stuart Simpson, who's a very well-known media investor and entrepreneur, and also a team of people he's had there. Josh Richards and Helen Constantelis, who are long-term, very experienced digital people. They've done a lot of the hard work. The company's profitable. It's got a great list of clients. So I'm hoping for a cakewalk.
I'm sure in digital nothing is ever quite as easy as that. You mentioned the list of clients. What would a typical client look to Switch Digital for?
A typical client, because of the experience of the people there, most of the people there have been around since the first dot-com boom. So by their very natures, they've established businesses. They've taken businesses from being very traditional, sometimes catalog-based businesses, and they've helped them with their business processes to become very advanced and digitally ahead. Now, there are still an enormous amount of clients in this market who are still catalog-based and realizing that they have to get another form of engagement, in the market. And this is what was really attractive about this opportunity, because you can't get a group of people that have that sort of experience over a long period of time. It's very hard to put them together. And so when I saw this opportunity, I saw there's a hole in the market. A lot of companies can put together a banner ad now. A lot of traditional agencies can now put together banner ads. But there are very few agencies that can take a traditional business to become digitally ahead and change their work processes. And that's incredibly exciting to me.
And for growth, do you see that growth coming from within Australia, or is, again, your regional experience going to come in as well? Are we going to see Switch sort of pushing harder elsewhere?
I think the best thing to do is to do what you do really well and cement your position where you are. So I'm really looking at Australia and New Zealand in the short term. But having said that, there are an enormous amount of opportunities in the region, but there are an enormous amount of opportunities in Australia that haven't been done. There's opportunities in video, there's opportunities in one-to-one marketing, and they haven't even touched these shores. And, you know, we're in for a very exciting time.
Well, next we talk about Mark Scott versus the Australian versus bloggers. So on Wednesday, ABC boss Mark Scott suggested that the Australian outed blogger Greg Jericho, who was known as Grog's Gamut, because its authority as a gatekeeper was being threatened. Chris, let me bring you in on this one. I mean, this is like one of those classic stories, isn't it? First of all, we've got classic sort of new digital media stories. So we've got this ongoing tussle between the Australian and the forces of Murdoch and the ABC, so two different points of view. And then we've got this battle between, you know, new media and the blogger and the Australian who outed him. Now, the key paragraph from
Mark Scott was it looked more like an objection to his authority, not his anonymity, symbolic of a larger unwillingness by the Australian to cede to a civilian journalist the ability to shape the agenda, a role the Australian and some other mainstream news organisations have long had to themselves. Grogs Gamut, like so many citizen blogs before it, had sidestepped the gatekeeper. Is that a world view that you share, Chris?
I think it absolutely is. I think that it's easy to dismiss this. It's easy to dismiss Greg Jericho as collateral damage in a war between News Corp and ABC, a war that's being played out the world over in the UK, for example, between Mark Thompson and the BBC and Murdoch's empire over there. So it would be easy to dismiss it as collateral damage. It's not. It's a lot more than collateral damage. This is a fundamental shift in content and how content is created and who has the power to create content. And I think it's, I would subscribe to Mark Scott's vision, which I think that News Corp absolutely objected to this person's influence.
Although one thing I sort of, one thought that has occurred to me, Lee, in recent months is maybe News have started to move on from that. You know, sort of remember John Hardigan giving a speech probably a year and a half ago talking angrily about, you know, the aggregators, and then giving one just a few months ago where it was far more, you felt that News was moving on and accepting that actually there were, you know, there were other new voices in the market and they had to earn their place.
I think that half of News Limited has moved on. And I think that you're looking at the management and the commercial areas within News Limited have moved on. But I don't necessarily think that, and I know we're getting on to the iPad conversations in a moment, but I don't necessarily think the editorial teams have moved on. And, you know, they talk about this concept of elitism, you know, and I certainly do think that that exists. And it still exists in unionised journalism today. And, look, in News Limited's defence, however, that they have a point. I think they probably approached it like this. They probably said, listen, there is a blogger who's become a credible news source. And there is an anonymous person, is an anonymous credible news source that people are using. Why shouldn't they be open to the same scrutiny and transparency that we are? And, you know, they've got a point. You know, if you're going to have a voice and you're going to be used as a credible source, then you should be open to scrutiny. And I think that would be probably the way News Limited approached it. It wasn't a vindictive position on the part of this, towards this blogger. It was about, well, if you're going to be a news provider, and if on Twitter we're going to be news providers, then you need transparency of that news provision and where you're from.
I mean, I remember wondering at the time, because the actual original outing was some time ago, whether some of it was just about how they did it as well. You know, the fact that it was a big back page story in the media section, as if it was a really big deal, his identity. Mm. Whereas if it had been a diary piece of a couple of bars, probably what it was worth, no one would have objected.
Look, I think you're probably true. Look, there's no doubt that there's a lot of concern with these major print-based journalists about control of news, the disintermediation of news and sources of trust. And they're having a lot of trouble getting their head around what that means for them. And again, in the iPad, the conversation that with the introduction of the iPads with the four editors, they said, we're the creators of news. And what we do is we put it on different devices and you read it. Mm. And this is their attitude. And look, that'll change, but it hasn't changed yet. I think that there's still a lot of debate about the role of, you know, citizen journalists and these organisations, and a lot of resistance to that.
Chris?
I think the point that I would make is that whenever I talk to an individual from those organisations, they work very hard to make it clear to me that they want to own the news agenda across the course of the day. They want to own the print in the morning, they want to own news on screens during the day, and they want to own the news agenda on tablets in the evening. And they're not going to do that with a polemic war on a changing culture in media and communication. They're going to win it by using the organisations to create and then distribute the best content.
I wonder, though, sometimes whether anyone outside these organisations makes the mistake of thinking, you know, it's often something people say about the Murdoch organisations, that they're working in concert. This idea that the reason the journalists wrote the story was because they were following the Murdoch agenda, rather than, you know, rightly or wrongly, thinking it was a good tale and a good story and they would just kind of go for it. And I'm not sure how much I buy into this idea that it was a complete conspiracy.
I don't know if I go as far as say it was a conspiracy. I think there are certainly agendas. All organizations have agendas. And I think that even if they're not explicit, I think that it would be strange if individuals in that organization didn't implicitly understand what that agenda was and work towards it.
And having worked at news myself before, there is no purposeful agenda. But you've got a lot of thought and time by the editors globally on wondering what would be acceptable to the Murdochs. That really is, if there is an agenda, it's not an obvious one. It's one that's through journalistic consideration.
Well, next, we talk about the Fairfax restructure. So Fairfax Media has announced that it's going to align its print mastheads with its digital as part of a kind of bigger restructure and regrouping. To me, it seems kind of logical that the same people who look after the fate of The Age or The Herald in print should also think about the branding online as well. Now, Lee, rather conveniently, everything we talk about, you seem to have worked there at some point. what do you see of the kind of restructurings this week from Fairfax? Sensible? Go far enough?
Well, it's actually what's not here in this release. And what's not in this release is what's the future of Jack Matthews and what role is Jack Matthews taking? Because if he's taking the head of those Metro, in the Metro, both of them, it's a very different position to if he's doing something else entirely.
Yes, because the digital divisions are now much smaller, aren't they? So there is there's the trading division, I think it is, you know, sort of online transactional division. So they're sort of broken out. So that obviously would be a smaller role than he's doing at the moment. But equally, the
influential.
Yes. The Metro division, obviously, he's never really done much print. So that would be the question is he in a position to
do that,
understand and manage print? And that's sort of the problem they've got, isn't it? You've got Brian McCarthy, very much, you know, kind of traditional. You know, he's been about managing the regional newspapers and managing cost. You've got McCarthy, who's been driving digital. Neither one of them is ideally placed.
No, look, and it's all about what the future for this business is going to be. If they're committed to a business that's digitally ahead in the long term, as opposed to an editorial agenda going into different channels, then Jack Matthews that is the right person. I mean, you've got to remember they've got editors, and they're editors in chief that are the guardians of the content, and the guardians of running these businesses. From what they really need is somebody who understands where these businesses are going to go in the next 10 years.
And for this Metro division, they've said they're recruiting a chief executive, which presumably means that Jack Matthews, among other people, can apply for the role.
Mm.
If you were on the board of Fairfax, looking inside Fairfax but looking outside, who in Australia would you appoint? Somebody who both knows print and traditional media, because don't forget that, you know, there's not in the same division, but, you know, Fairfax got radio interest, but somebody who's got the print knowledge and also a kind of forward-looking digital view.
Look, they're very light on the ground. Somebody who really understands these issues deeply. Nick Leader at News Limited, who's currently running the Australia, has a very intimate knowledge of both of these businesses and a very good track record.
Would they ever? They wouldn't budge someone like him out of news, though, would they?
I wouldn't think so. He's playing an important role there. But very much so, very light on the ground in terms of the talent. Certainly the US, there may be some talent. But one thing to remember, though, is that they criticise the separation of print and online at Fairfax. But the one thing that isn't brought out is that the Fairfax Online division is almost alone in its success as a digital division of a newspaper group.
But would it be if it wasn't getting all of that free content out of the print division?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. So Jack Matthews would say, well, only 30% of our content now comes out of the traditional newspapers. The rest comes out of feeds and user-generated content. And so he would argue that it's quite a separate business. But having said that, you've got a business whose profit, whose EBIT, the digital business, whose EBIT is now larger than the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and the Australian Financial Review print editions put together. Now, that takes, at least you should stop to pause about what you're going to do with these assets, because you look at the Hearst Group, you can look at the New York Times. This isn't replicated anywhere, and it's just food for thought.
Chris?
I couldn't agree more. I think that there's no doubt that this is a very, very important moment for Fairfax. And I think that that what's missing from this press release speaks volumes. And I think that what there is far too much of in this press release are big, bold statements about transforming a business model and about future-proofing. What you need is a vision for the future, and that's what they need. And it isn't about who's well-equipped to manage print or who's well-equipped to manage online. The fact is the future is digital. Yeah. And this is a moment to put someone in place who understands that and can work to that.
Well, a little bit later we'll be talking more about the future of newspapers and digital with News Limited. But next we'll be talking about no more hubris for Photon. So this week it was the Photon AGM. Relatively new boss Jeremy Phillips declared that the company will avoid risky investments for the time being and also avoid celebrating acquisitions just for the sake of celebrating. Whatever can he mean?
My fellow Australians, un-Australianism continues to spread faster than algae on an Olympic sailing course, and the marketing and communications industry is no exception. The local scene is still dominated by multinational dinosaurs, with enough deadwood to keep China's smokestacks burning well into the next century. They're all run by ponytail-wearing, Porsche-driving Yanks in New York, or bespectacled, bespoke-suited bean counters in London, or even man-bag-carrying croissant munchers in Paris. And they wouldn't recognise a local consumer if one kicked them up the bum, which they should, for treating them like idiots and bombarding them with endless old-school 30-second TV campaigns. It's an absolute disgrace. As a fully integrated multimedia megastar myself, I can assure you the consumers aren't stupid. They just want to be engaged and entertained, which is why they're so fond of yours truly. And because today's consumer is in control, the media-neutral, consumer-driven Photon Group is sticking it to the overseas juggernauts. They must be suffering in their jocks of being shown how it's done by an Aussie company, especially one led by a nuggety ex-South Sydney hooker from Dubbo, who stuck his head in the one too many scrums, and a lanky spiv, who despite being blessed by being from Melbourne, has the misfortune of being a Collingwood supporter. These blokes have assembled a collection of nimble, locally focused misfits that would be about as comfortable in the global multinational as a free Tibet protester in Beijing. So Photon moves with the times. That's why 85% of its earnings are from non-traditional forms of marketing. Unlike the monolithic TV-centric multinationals that are harder to steer than James Tonkin's rowing boat when the rudder broke. It's no wonder Photon's profits are rising faster than the average bloke's pulse after Stephanie Rice's undershoot. For example, net revenue grew 94% year on year to $376.8 million. And EBITDA grew 74% year on year to $78.2 million. Maybe they could splash out on a new corporate ID instead of a bit of spray can graffiti they've got now. Those with a mind for minutiae can click on the links for all the figures. For the rest of you, the bottom line is this. If you want to back a winner, get behind Photon. And remember to eat lamb on Australia Day. You know it makes sense. I'm Sam Kekovich.
So that clip was to accompany the 2008 annual report, so a couple of years back. That was Sam Kekovich talking somewhat triumphantly about Photon Group, which was then riding quite high. It must have been really intriguing being in the market, seeing Photon come from nowhere, go to the heights it was, and you know, very nearly fail.
Yeah, look, you're looking at Q Limited, you can look at Blue Freeway, you can look at Photon, all using the same model, buying a business at 6x multiples and listing it at 12x multiples and hoping the cash will never run out. Now, the cash did run out. Jeremy Phillips was very brave to step into that role, and he's got a lot of hard work to do. Are the senior executives of Photon getting paid over the odds? Most likely, you know, to be the custodian of a business like that and to be getting $1.2 million or, you know, dollars plus you know, bonuses and plus everything else is a handsome premium for a business that needs significant restructuring. When you combine with that, that a lot of the business owners out of these very important businesses have left the business.
You've seen Stuart Bailey leave the Bailey Group, which obviously was the field marketing arm, and that has been a big profit driver, for instance. So yeah, we are, you know, we're seeing some of the senior people move on. But at 8 cents, you almost wonder whether a few Photon shares are worth a punt.
Yeah, it's a good point. How much lower can it go?
Because it'll either fail and you lose all your money, or you'll make a healthy profit. I don't think there'll be an in-between position.
I mean, the comparison was made between investing in Image versus investing in Blue Freeway, and they still use that comparison, you know, moving forward with other Australian-based, you know, listed businesses like STW. And, you know, even on, it's not just about will the shares go up. Most certainly they've got nowhere else to go but up. but will they go up? And will you enjoy multiples of your money over the longer term that you can in other marketing services businesses? And this is where the debate, where Citibank put out a report that says even at 8 cents, sometimes these shares may not be a bargain because of the gains you can make in other sectors.
Chris?
The point I'm making this is it strikes me as a very safe, very solid, a very reserved statement. I think that's exactly the right thing to do. I think that it's easy to forget that what there is within Photon, a lot of very talented individuals, and I think that what they need is a period of stability and a period of certainty to get on with doing what they do.
Well, next, Qantas consumers lose faith. Now, a survey by Auspol this week suggested that 65% of consumers were now leaning in the direction of Virgin Blue rather than Qantas following its many brand-damaging technical problems. It's one of those questions that always comes up when an airline's had some sort of emergency and bad PR. Lee, is there long-term damage for the brand, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, there's not a lot of competition in the Australian airline landscape, and so I don't think that the damage will be lasting. And don't forget, a lot of other people have these Rolls-Royce engines, and a lot of other companies are facing very similar situations. But having said that, what you saw here is a bad response to a real-time event, and it's a company that didn't have a real-time search strategy. It's not just Twitter, it's real-time search. How can I get real-time information to my consumers? And Twitter just happens to be one of the biggest ones. But you're looking at consumers looking elsewhere and not to the traditional media and news sources to get information that's more current and that, through crowds, the theory is it's over time it's more reliable. But having said that, for short emergencies, in this particular case, it proved unreliable.
For a while, if you were looking at Twitter, you would have assumed that there had been a crash or an explosion. It was funny actually watching it online, and of course you were seeing just the speed with which the Qantas PR response was or wasn't responding. You could see it online as well. So, for instance, I remember seeing a story, I think, on the SMH, where there was a quote in the story quite high up from someone at Qantas saying there's no evidence to suggest that our plane has been involved in this incident. And at the same time with the same story was a giant picture of half of an engine cover with the red and white on it right next to what now clearly looked like a ridiculous quote. And it's just that fast-moving thing. And actually, and just in fairness to Qantas, just to pull out the stats, so Auspol talked about 1,500 consumers. 21% said that they believed Qantas was unsafe. And perhaps the other key number was that 65% of respondents said that the recent problems have made them less confident in the airline than before. And then when they were asked to score various airlines, Virgin Blue came out top with 83% rating Qantas as safe and only 69% rating Virgin Blue as safe and only 69% rating Qantas as safe. Chris, what do you think? A little mini PR crisis of the day or something more long term?
Well, it's a mini PR crisis of the day. What the long term story is that this is the result of a long running dispute between Qantas management and maintenance staff. This is the result of that they moved their maintenance offshore, and there was a long running dispute. And for 18 months, Qantas maintenance staff have been briefing the media on anything and everything that's going wrong. And we're seeing an internal dispute being played out in the media, on all media, mainstream media and social media.
So it's not the effect on the safety of the dispute, it's the human response to the dispute.
As my housemate Paul is fond of saying, as big fans of air crash investigation, it takes an awful lot to bring a plane down. A lot has got to go wrong.
I love air crash investigation.
Is one of the wonders of modern
broadcasting. That is my guilty pleasure. At any given time, I probably have a dozen episodes on my Foxtel IQ. And there's next, from the Stone Age to flying cars.
This is the big crystal ball. I mean, had we been sitting here a year ago, I couldn't have told you that we'd be publishing on this tablet, this touchscreen, this amazing thing that really comes to life and breathes new life into your stories. I didn't know it was coming. So where are we going to be in a year's time, 5 years' time? I mean, we've gone from being the Flintstones to the Jetsons in one big step, and we've done it in a very short space of time. And I think I don't really know what's coming. All I know is I'm confident that we're now in that headspace where we know that we just want to publish great stories, and it's the storytelling is the one thing that hasn't changed.
So that clip was Daily Telegraph editor Gary Linnell chatting to me actually on Friday of last week. News Limited, I think for the first time ever, put up the four editors of their four big metro papers. It was to coincide with the launch of iPad apps for two of them and the coming launch very shortly. And it was the interesting thing is, you know, you as you've alluded to already, Lee, it was four guys who've very much grown up within print. You know, just at the beginnings of getting to grips with another technology and another opportunity. Now, to a certain extent, I recognised that I was completely drinking the Kool-Aid, but I came away almost for the first time thinking, they really mean this. You know, this isn't just, you know, kowtowing to what Rupert Murdoch says and sort of humouring the old man. The senior management at News now believe that iPads are what's going to save journalism. Are they right?
It's a hard question to answer, really. So there's a couple of parts to that. You say, well, are these tablet devices going to take off? And most certainly they are. I believe the figure was some 40 million iPads were sold in the first quarter. I believe it was a figure, something like that. So there's no doubt that these tablet devices are a behavioural change. But the question is, are they going to go to paid devices or subscription-based devices on these tablet devices, or are they going to just go to the websites and the news sites that are free? You know, will they say, "Yes, I will go to this iPad, you know, application and have a shallow news experience of the day, or will I do what I've always been doing and have a deep news experience in multiple sources?" And I think that the jury's still out on that, and I would not be rushing to claim that this is going to be the saviour of newspapers. I think there's a long road to go.
Chris, you're nodding at that.
iPads are not going to save news journalism. What's going to save news journalism is platform neutrality, content first, and being able to sufficiently monetize some of that content in some places enough to subsidize the rest of the business. And iPad just happens to be the newest version of that. It was quite an extraordinary video watching these four very senior people clutch on to the tablets of stone, like the commandments themselves, holding onto them. It was like, these are the most aggressive disciples in the cult of Apple. As Apple has gone mainstream, the new disciples have emerged from the most unlikely place.
Well, one of the things that has broken this week as well is that there appears to be a secret floor at News in the US where they're launching The Daily. I'm not sure if that's just the working title, the real thing, but they're saying about 100 journalists working on it. The idea being that this will be an iPad-only newspaper. Won't have a website to go with it, so there will be no platform neutrality. The price seems quite
iTunes cheap for news.
Yeah, iTunes for news is probably a good way of putting it. And one of my first thoughts was, blimey, I wonder if we'll see a version for Australia. Having chatted to one or two people who sort of should know the scene, they're sort of pointing out that in the US there's a lot less to lose for news, in that it's not as if they have a metro newspaper in each city. So, you know, even if they can, you know, get the paper on, get the, call it a paper if you like, but get the product onto 5% of tablets in the US, then it makes commercial sense to do it. And I'm not sure it will for Australia. But do you see the idea of a tablet-only publication? Do you think there could be a business niche for it?
Not if they're going to replicate the same behaviour they have with their traditional business, that iNews Limited own the franchise of deciding what you view as news, and I'm going to hand it down to you. And I think that there are an enormous amount of opportunities for these applications, not just on Apple-based devices, but also on Android-based devices. It is enormous. But you've got to understand the tribal and the very tribal way in which these people behave, and the tribal way they behave by both device and location. And I'm not entirely sure whether 100 journalists sitting in a floor in New York is the answer to that.
I suppose where maybe I disagree with you is, for me, one of the greatest magazines in the world is The Economist. the fact that it's now on an iPad has for the first time made me think that it's available on a Thursday night Australian time rather than if you really lucky Saturday morning to get the print product. Has actually for the first time made me think I can actually see how I might use an iPad now. But the thing about The Economist, whether it's in print, whether it's an iPad, is, and I really, really hate this word, but it's curating. It's finding interesting stuff, it's writing about it well and intelligently and bringing, you know, they're saying this is the interesting and relevant, important stuff for this week that we've gone out and found for you. And that's what any, you know, what any good paper does, what potentially The Daily would do. And that effectively is them handing it, them saying we know our readers and we're handing it over to them what we think it is they'll want.
I think the point to that, though, is that with both The Economist and Vanity Fair, which is another great example of that curation, is that here we get it a week late. And by then, whatever's in it is not news, and yet it's still valuable to us. And why is that? You know, it's because we're getting views and researched opinion and access to things that the news organisations don't provide. So it's still current, even though it's not news anymore by the time we usually get both of those publications.
But isn't that where The Daily comes in? The fact that they're a dedicated journalist. You know, this isn't just repurposing, you know, news core content from elsewhere. This is going to be new individual journalism that you have to buy in the same way you would buy a newspaper.
Well, I mean, it's daily news is all we've got so far. So is that any different to going to abc.net.au or to SMH?
I think the opportunity for The Daily is to be both. The opportunity is to be curation and aggregation. And if you look at the iTunes model, what is brilliant about the iTunes model is it has ubiquity and crowdsources of what's popular right at the top. At the same time, the most valuable bit of real estate is the front page, which is curated by the editors. And I think that that duality is what works. And I think that it would be a huge mistake to debate about one or the other. It's bringing both to news in the way that iTunes brings it to music, which makes this a phenomenally interesting venture. And I look forward greatly to Steve Jobs and Rupert Murdoch being up on stage with no doubt a great triumphal press release and announcement and PR going ballistic when they do so.
And it could happen this side of Christmas by the sounds of it, the announcement. Anyway, next up, Iron Chef is no Master Chef. So on TV this week, Iron Chef bowed out. We are at the end of TV ratings season. By the time you hear this, we'll be in the last day of the TV ratings. So Iron Chef took a bit of a dive with its final episode, went well below a million. But The X Factor pulled in 1.6 for its final, so 7 okay with that, I guess. The Block on Wednesday night delivered 1.7 million for its final, so again, 9 would be happy enough for that. But actually, you're just the person who can explain this to me, actually, because this has bugged me for the last 4 years. I hope you can, anyway.
No pressure.
No pressure, but your media agency had this idea that there's a rating season that matters, and there's 15 weeks a year or however many years where it doesn't matter and the TV channels can put out any old rubbish they want and it doesn't count. You know, to me that just completely leaves the viewers out of the equation. What's the explanation?
Look, I'm not, you know, that's like some of these things, like, you know, TV ratings and the way they worked out, you know, they're based on things that happened a long time ago and we're in a different world. But one of the things that it did give as an agency, it did give us enormous opportunities, was to look at sponsored, you know, client-generated opportunities in those non-ratings periods that still did very well. So last year we did with Tourism Australia No Leave, No Life, which was consistently, you know, generating 800, 900, all over Australia, 1.2, 1.3 million viewers. Now, you can't do that in ratings periods. Very difficult for these free-to-air stations in particular to take a punt on these types of programs. So in some ways, it's actually very good for clients. And in some ways, if you've got a client that's content rich, that needs to have a voice and needs to get a deeper, you know, relationship with the consumer, it's been fantastic. But look, there's no doubt that you know, it's a mystery. Everyone goes on holidays and it's checkout time. Yep, it's ironically in the busiest period of the advertising, you know, calendar leading up to Christmas. But it's one of those mysteries. I'm sorry, I can't help you with that one.
Yeah, I always find it a complete mystery. And, of course, what it does mean is there's generally dreadful television as well. Chris, a few to unpick here. I guess a couple of format punts from Seven, first of all. So they took Iron Chef and they Australianised that. They took the X Factor, which Ten had previously had a run at. What do you make? Successes, failures?
I think X Factor hasn't lived up to what it could have been. I think that as a beloved and adoring fan of X Factor, I think
X Factor UK.
X Factor UK. I think it's a fantastic format. I think that what Seven never quite realised is that X Factor is not a singing competition, and they tried the whole thing, they produced the whole thing as a singing competition. It's not. It's a platform for people's stories. It's a platform to support people or dislike people or cheer for people. And they never really allowed us to get on the emotional journeys of these people. It's something that Ryan back in PhD Towers keeps reminding me. It's like, I just felt like I didn't know these people, and that was a great opportunity missed.
And was that about, how much of that was about the judges, for instance?
It's a lot about the judges. I think the same goes for them. I think that when you approach producing those judges as singing judges, you will always get slightly two-dimensional results out of them. I think that one of the great things about X Factor is that as soon as you approach their rivalry, as soon as you approach them as three-dimensional people, it becomes much more compelling television. It becomes very compelling television, and it wasn't really ever compelling enough.
Do you think it just needs a bit of time to kind of grow into it? This is something that evolves, because of course, you know, it's the X Factor. I don't know how many series it's had in the UK, but it's had several to get to the level of obsession it now gets.
Yeah, and the current season, phenomenal success in the UK. I think it takes more than time. I think it's going to take a perception shift with the production team. They've got to stop producing a singing competition, and they've got to start producing a programme that's about people and about people's journeys and taking us on those journeys.
How do you feel about Australian television just getting these international formats and remaking them? I mean, is that a problem? Is it a sensible thing to do?
I think it's very sensible because it's cheap, particularly these formats, and free-to-air, you know, all TV actually needs cheap content. You know,
I actually assume the X Factor will be quite expensive to do because of, you know, it's a live production each week.
Yeah, look, but it's all about also the shoulders of that program and the types of content you can put on the shoulders of that program as well.
I mean, so the programs that sit each side of it, for instance.
Yeah, and you know, how you run it up to your news. And so it's looking at the whole package and what sort of its effect does across the board. And these formats can drive your content prices down if they're done properly. It's a global. You know, I was talking to the producer who did The Bachelorette or something appalling in France. And this is a global phenomenon. It's not a local one. They're done badly. You know, in terms of will time improve these programs? I don't know whether if you go to, say, You Think You Can Dance or Big Brother or any of those, there's no evidence that time improves these. Usually time makes everything much worse.
Yeah, I tell you what, my big frustration of, actually not this year but last year, was I was so excited when The Apprentice came to Australia because I really like the US version of The Apprentice, so I'm happily, again, my Foxtel IQ is getting a bit of a workout at the moment because it's running on Fox 8, the new series, and they're just as dislikable as ever, which is brilliant. Absolutely loved the UK version of The Apprentice. Was so excited for the Australian one, and it was a real disappointment. But I couldn't tell you why. I honestly couldn't. As a viewer, I couldn't tell you why.
There's another very important... Well, I think as a viewer is the point. I think what the element that's often missing in these programmes is that they, the same way they 50 weeks of the year just pretend the viewer exists, when they're making these programmes, they forget the viewers exist. One of the great things about these formats elsewhere is that they genuinely produce these platforms as though they're in a two-way dialogue with viewers, with people, and they encourage conversation. I think, and you see in the UK phenomenal Twitter effects when the program's live. It's an affirmation of live television in many ways. And they just don't do it over here.
Well, with Twitter, do you think the fact that we're in more than one time zone in Australia, do you think that actually hurts the communal nature of watching television now with social media?
It certainly affects the online playout. I know for a fact that the online deployment in across networks is delayed because you've got to wait for Western Australia. So on the eastern coast, the online will always delay the live TV broadcast. I think that is a factor.
But you know, something like, you know, say people watching The Block last night. Yeah. If you're in Perth, or last night as we're talking, during the night before last, by the time you hear this, bit of a time delay there. But in Perth, you know, you have to know that you've got to stay off Twitter for the next few hours if you don't want to know the winner. I guess it's a US model where they have the East Coast, West Coast thing in the same way. But I just wonder if that's something that the networks haven't really grappled with yet.
I think the networks haven't quite grasped the idea the viewer is there and they want to be engaged and they want to be involved. And there is a huge opportunity for those networks that will realise it first and start doing it first.
Well, next, a couple of new beers, Cascade and Carlton Draft. Were you about to come in on there?
No, I can
ask the question again.
The last time I watched reality TV, I think I was still in school. So yeah.
I won't force you on that one then. Right. Next, couple of new beer ads for Cascade and Carlton Draft.
Hello, Australia. I'm Steven Seagal. You know, a lot of actors pretend to be tough guys. I am a tough guy. And now I'm getting ready for my toughest role yet. You. Carlton Dry wants to make the movie of your most funny or exciting story, starring me as you. Dig it.
Enter your story at carltondry.com.au.
So that voice you just heard was action hero Steven Seagal offering us the promise of making a movie with you, the consumer, in it. Now, one of the cruelest things in the comment thread on this one was the number of people actually thought that the joke was going to be he wasn't really Steven Seagal, he was like his fatter older brother with a new plastic face and Lego hair.
Sausage eating the sausage, I think, was one of the comments.
Yeah. What did you make of that ad?
Well, what I'm really out of it, it's I applaud it for being an engaging idea executed in an ad rather than an ad for an ad's sake. There's clearly been some thought given to how can we create something that's going to engage people and involve people. And then the ad becomes the platform for that rather than the ad being the ad in itself.
And you can see the idea being, okay, great, we'll get an action hero, we'll sign them up, they'll be the one who promises it. Let's get Steven Seagal. And by the time they signed the contracts and checked it out, you go to film it on the day, they realise he's not like he was.
Yeah, I think one of the comments from Ben on the National Post was that it was a great idea but could have been better executed, and I think I would subscribe to that.
Look, I've got two questions. You think Steven Seagal really? Was Chuck Norris and Scott Baio busy at the time?
Well, Jean-Claude Van Damme had launched a campaign that week for Sony Pictures, so he presumably was out of play.
Did Stallone have a sore throat? I mean, Steven Seagal, really? And the second thing that amazed me is that they had to film it in Canada because he was filming a movie. Where is that movie going to go? Is it straight to video? Is it straight to oblivion?
Really?
I mean, where do these shows go? I think the big ad, the Carlton Draft big ad, has a lot to answer for these latest formats.
Yeah, although, of course, a lot of the people behind the big ad were involved in this as well. You know, so the some of the guys at Clemenger, BBDO, Melbourne now who are behind this were behind the big ad.
Yeah.
And, of course, Clem's putting out a lot of beer work at the moment. The Pure Blonde stuff last week came out of them as well. So, it's kind of busy seasons. Now, one other ad out this week was for Cascade, the good old Tasmanian brewery. Lee, what did you think of that?
I think it's a beautiful ad. You know, it's beautifully done. But the only thing I would say, it's a 1 minute TVC.
And it's worth describing. We were going to play the clip, but then we realised that it's all about the visual thing, so it's probably worth describing it rather than playing the clip.
So it's a wonderful 1 minute TVC about a wonderful ride through a village and avoiding obstacles because, Cascade have, third sight on how to make beer, therefore they don't get hit by tractors or run over Tasmanian...
By Tasmanian tigers.
It looked like a rodent to me. I didn't know what it was. But so that's great. But when you get down to the sale of beer, there's a lot more to it than a 1 minute TVC, which is I felt was a little bit indulgent. It takes more than that. It takes great point of sale. It takes great on-pack. It takes great messaging. And there wasn't enough evidence, in this, this very expensive ad that you can probably only run, affordably in cinema, to actually understand where this is going.
Do you think it would cut down reasonably well as a 30-second ad?
Oh, look, I think it would be, but it still had the expense of making a minute program, a minute TVC. And we're not talking about Woolworths here. We're talking about Cascade Lager. if you look at an equivalent product, which is Fiji Water, which is just taking over the number one spot globally in terms of water sales, they've got one message, and it's the purest water in the world. Now, Cascade shares that very same message with beer. They quite rightfully claim, because of where they are, they're the purest beer in the world, and they do claim that.
And I suppose the problem is another brand has grabbed the Pure Waters message already, so it would look a bit Me Too for them to go in that direction.
Well, they had it first. They had the Pure message first was Cascade's message.
Is it them sort of ceding territory, actually, by moving in this direction?
Well, they're different categories, but I'm just saying that they have a very clean, simple message that they can activate across channels right through the path to purchase. And so to have your hero is an ad that you can't affordably do in many places. It just seemed a bit over the top. You could have done a 30-second ad and then used the money on point of sale and on pack, and maybe for the client it was a better result. But beautiful ad, and Droga5 have done a great job.
Chris?
A wonderfully forgettable ad for a waning broadcast age.
Well, on that bombshell, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to our guests, Chris and Lee.
Thanks, pleasure, Luffy. Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you to CBS Interactive for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle pip.